This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 005. On the show today, I'm delighted to welcome John Volmir, CEO of R5FX.com. Dodd-Frank and other upcoming regulation require significant changes to the trading of emerging market foreign exchange. Amongst other things, this is to increase transparency in a market which is around $100 billion turnover every day. R5 is creating an electronic trading platform for emerging market currencies, which is focusing on moving the market from voice to screen. John is a great match for what I see as the real fintechers in the city right now, to pick three reasons. Firstly, he has great domain expertise in foreign exchange. It's another story for another time, but the idea that a, quotes, teenager on a sofa, unquotes, the usual Silicon Valley archetype, with no domain expertise, can suddenly create something worthwhile in FS is, to me, something of a fantasy. Financial services is, as anyone with time under their belt knows, complex. Even if you come up with a simple solution, you do need to understand the complexity in the first place. Secondly, he's been involved in a variety of creative gigs over his career. As ever larger corporates in financial services become de facto more and more like processing machines, it gets ever tougher to innovate from inside the machine, and thus creativity is getting squeezed out and emerging in these new fintechs. Thirdly, John is a top bloke. Having lunch with him recently, he was, for example, explaining to me the protocols of Albanian weddings, a topic about which I am strangely unfamiliar. I was reminded of the city in the 1980s when everyone had something interesting to say outside of financial services as well as within it. Indeed, it is no surprise that the most creative folks do have the widest horizons. Very tough to be creative if you wear blinkers. So let's get on with the show. Hi, John. Thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Mike. Thanks very much.
Before we get into the show, as usual, I'd like to sort of ask about where you've been, but maybe as I've raised the subject, maybe you want to share with the listeners, in case it's ever of relevance to them, some of the secrets of Albanian weddings, perhaps.
Well, I'd like perhaps first stress that it wasn't my Albanian wedding. I was merely a guest.
My cousin's Albanian wedding.
Yeah. But it was an awful lot of fun, and Granddad's raki was certainly the highlight of the entire event. But very unusual compared to, say, your average wedding in this country. I think, like we were saying the other day, that no sort of religious person at all. It was more sort of a my village, your village type kind of thing. But made for a great day out, it really was.
I remember when I was at school, so this is quite a while ago, some chums of mine who wanted to go somewhere alternative managed to go on holiday to Albania in the late 70s, and they got tours of tractor factories and all that kind of stuff. I'm also curiously unfamiliar with Albanian currency. What do they have over there, and is it one of your emerging market currencies you're trading?
It is the Albanian lek, and
of course, yes.
It is not actually one of our launch pack. No disrespect for anyone from Albania, but it's not a heavily traded foreign exchange pair.
And in terms of your background in foreign exchange, as I was saying, having something relevant in terms of really understanding a market before you innovate that market, how long have you been at this whole FX thing, and how come you've ended up where we are today in level 39?
I'm more than 20 years now in the foreign exchange world. Started with Reuters for a long time in New York. Got transferred here to set up something. Left to join a startup called Currynext. Yes,
well, currency. Back in the day, all the FX traders I knew had lots of lager and curry.
Yeah. Well, Currynext was effectively what we would call today a fintech startup. Bunch of guys in a room from California, sold for several hundred million dollars 7 years later.
Which year are we talking roughly now?
That was the 2000.
Okay.
And then it sold in, I think it was 2007, for around 600 million.
Yes, it's interesting. As I was saying in the first episode, fintech is something which has come to mean what it's come to mean pretty recently. And recently I was talking to Eddie George in one of the prior episodes. But everything kind of doesn't come from nowhere. And looking back, there are all sorts of things which with hindsight you could call fintechs.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's a new term for an old thing, perhaps. Probably the difference, though, is that it is a lot more open these days. You know, it was very, very hard to start your own financial technology company, and now that's a bit easier.
Yeah. So you can just scale really quickly. Servers are cheap to buy. You don't have to run your own one. Lots of things you can get. and more support for the ecosystem, as we'll come on to perhaps, and we're part of the ecosystem support here at Level 39, which is certainly getting a lot of attention in the media right now, and quite rightly so, for pushing ahead with initiatives to help London FinTech. Before we get on to the sort of the big thing then, so how come you and your chums set up R5? What led you to that? Desire or frustration, or both?
The perfect scenario, I think. We were approached by a couple of banks who were, okay, hi, we're having a problem with this particular piece of the marketplace. We can't electronically price our customer in emerging market currencies because it's a voice-broked marketplace. There's the disconnect. And how can we fix that?
Just to be clear, as you were explaining the other day, but just for the purpose of the listeners, if we go back, all markets used to be archetypally voice-based. So a bunch of guys standing around shouting in futures exchange, I remember, for the 1970s, and throwing pieces of paper in the air. And then, of course, as computers have got cheaper, faster, et cetera, more and more of the city, which will probably not be obvious to people outside the big buildings, but if you're inside any big building, there's a bunch of guys on telephones looking at screens, typing and pressing buttons. However, interestingly, and I'm not quite sure why, that wave hasn't gone the whole way through. So there are still some markets which are basically trading pretty much as they would have traded in the Roman Empire. mouth to ear, ear to mouth.
Including Albanian Lex.
No, that's part of the empire.
You're dead right. There are some fabulous old Reuters photos of guys with 6 telephones in their ears and another 10 telephones in front of them. And along came Reuters Dealing, which was effectively the first chat room, then electronic trading itself. We're on perhaps, you know, the 10th version of that now. And during that time, pockets of the market, like you say, didn't really get adoption in it. Options is another area. So up until recently, that was still very manual. Now that's fully electronic. Same with our area in emerging markets. Now we're offering the electronic alternative.
So again, fortunately, it does happen to tie in with what I was saying at the beginning, which is that with your basis of 20 years experience inside the industry and the basis of having seen the journey of other markets from blah, blah to typing on screens or pressing buttons or whatever, the patterns are all there. And so just simplifying your task in a way, very simply, in a way, all you need to do is, quote, execute, which makes it sound very simple, of course.
It does make it sound very simple, doesn't it?
Well, it is simple, your job. I mean, my job's tough, but yours, well, I could do that.
I don't think it's got easier to do. It's certainly got cheaper to do.
Right.
You know, at Currenex, we spend $100 million building a service.
Okay.
Now you can do something quite similar to that for an awful lot less. Doesn't mean that making the
10 million or 1 million? I mean, just give it a rough
10,
idea.
10, yeah, you can okay. easily
so
put it
tenfold,
off with
10. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, separately, in a totally different context, somebody had also said to me that compared to 10 years ago, it's now 10 times cheaper to do a fintech startup than it would have been 10 years ago.
I agree. Absolutely.
So, as we're saying, my joking apart, it's never actually easy to get anything off the ground. A new aeroplane has to be built, it has to fly. There's all the same steps you've got to go through that you had to go through in the past. So I quite liked your soundbite that it's cheaper, but not necessarily easier. So what are the sort of key things for you then about executing and delivering so that whether it's 1, 2, 3 years' time, I don't know what time scale we're working on here, but for the sake of argument, let's fast forward. And you know, you guys are known as the emerging market foreign exchange platform that everybody has, which would obviously make your day.
That would certainly make me happy, yeah. And that is the goal, no doubt about that. I mean, I think when you look at the sort of the fintech journey, as it were, is quite similar across all of them. You've got a couple of guys in a big firm who have suggested a better way of doing it to their boss or their boss's boss, get frustrated because that doesn't seem to get very far, and eventually go, well, stuff this, and we'll go out and start our own company. Now, when they do that, they discover that actually, hang on a second, building a startup is actually A, very, very hard. B, includes a whole bunch of things that you didn't realize it did.
Yeah.
Which is why things like where we are here at Level 39, FinTech Innovate, all of the sort of clusters and assistance, Eddie's London New Finance, all of these things are incredibly useful and very important for that group. And a number of those are getting a lot further down the track than you would have if we were trying to do this 5 years ago.
It's a very interesting point. You will understand because you've been in a large organization, therefore you know what components it takes to make a business as opposed to an idea or some IT system. But many of the people I meet haven't actually got to that stage, by which I mean that you need a product, you need marketing, you need sales, you need client servicing, you need the whole circle, as I see it, going round and round and round. And actually, just talking to Eddie about this week, and he said that he thinks that fintech is 2 years through a 10-year journey. The stage we're at the moment, there are quite a few people out there, quotes, doing fintech, who don't particularly understand marketing in the same way that you would if you'd been in a bank for 10 years. So marketing, oh yeah, we'll get some PR. And the sales, oh, that's easy. We just get a sales money, you'll go and sell it. But again, if you've been in an organization, even if you hated those departments or the guys that did it, or maybe you did it yourself, you appreciate that, again, everything is quite tricky. It's quite tricky building a product. It's also quite tricky doing marketing, by which my definition of marketing is arousing interest, increasing awareness in something. You then pass that over to the sales process. The sales process is taking interest and turning that into a contract. And then the client part of it, the client hand-holding, whatever financial services you're in, is taking a contract and turning it into a happy client in the medium term.
You mentioned marketing there, and I think that's an easy one, because we have a lot of fun with our marketing. And the reason for that is because we're not constrained in the same way that a big bank has to use this particular color, blue, like that. We don't have any of those restrictions. We've created a lot of buzz and a lot of attention using our marketing because we're not constrained in that way. But in that same way of marketing creates sales, sales creates contracts, contracts and creates clients. Similar thing, we use a lot of technology around that. We use Evernote, we use Dropbox, we use Asana, we use services like that to streamline that kind of thing. In a traditional service, there's a department for that, We're using a technology for that.
But notoriously in FX, the sales cycle can be incredibly long, whether you're using Evernote or not, or whether you're sort of writing that on a Frank packet, because the banks are big, slow, bureaucratic, procurement lists, blah, 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 blah. But from what I was saying earlier, you guys do have the advantage, although this regulation can be moving feast, that regulation will come in by a certain time, and by the 15th of February, you, the bank, have to trade on an exchange or prove it was the right price or best execution, and all these phrases I first heard in the 1980s when it was the TSA or whatever it was called then, or the SFA. SFA it was called, the SFA. There was a TSA as well. So presumably there is this pressure on the banks to actually end up having to close, because otherwise one of the other things which kills fintechs can be you can have a great idea, you can turn that into great software, you can actually do the marketing bit and get people interested, you can have the sales conversation and that kind of stuff, and it can just go on for quite a long time. It's a bit like if I said to you, hey, John, I'm running a Pilates class. I think you really need a Pilates class. It'd be great for you. I could even convince you of that. You go, yeah, sure. And you add that to your infinitely long list of things to do and you never quite get around to it.
I do definitely need a Pilates class.
Nothing personal, and actually I am starting one.
Yeah, maybe we can get one of those.
Just turn it into a fintech somehow.
You raise the good point there. I mean, like, having been someone who's been selling technology-led change for a long time, that's a good place to be in. And where we are is regulatory enforced technology-led change. And that's about as nirvana as you can get if you're a fintech startup. Of that part of the marketplace is forced to look at the way that it does things today and do it in a different way. And hey, why not do it quicker, faster, better at the same time? And you're also right, the lead time is very, very long on banks. But once they make the change, they do tend to stick with it, which is another sort of good part to it. And if they like it, then it's even better again.
Yeah. And you've got the first mover advantage. I mean, I heard about Evernote recently, that Evernote's got a great business model, because once everybody's got all their stuff in Evernote, it's a huge pain to then move from something else. And it's the same thing with trading platforms or something. Once you're used to going through the London Stock Exchange, listing on the London Stock Exchange, et cetera, it's quite a big hassle to then sort of shift to something else.
It either has to be considerably better or a hell of a lot cheaper.
And I think the other thing I'd just like to pick out of what we're talking about for fintechy people, especially the sort of younger fintechy people who don't have the breadth of business experience, I emphasized at the beginning the fact that you've been in this market for 20 odd years means you understand the problems of the market. But we kind of both glossed over the fact that actually it makes the marketing a hell of a lot easier, because you know the guys. You've known them for decades. You've been out for many, many beers over decades. So you know the right people. So you just have to get the word out. It's not a question of you trying to get yourself in the 9 o'clock news or in the sort of FT or London Financial News going blah, blah, blah to people you've never met. Everybody's talking about this stuff. Everyone knows the regulations there. Everyone's looking for a tick box solution.
No, you're dead right. And the other sort of part to that is when you look at that as a whole, we would say that we're disrupting from within. We're not trying to break the bank or get rid of banking or anything of that sort of nature. Banks are our customers. We're trying to make a bank's life or a trader's life a hell of a lot easier than what it is today. Banks are our friends in this respect. The other piece to that is, we're not retail. We're not trying to appeal to the man in the street. You're dead right. We know exactly who our customer is. Our customer is a professional foreign exchange trader at a big foreign exchange bank around the world. And there are a lot of these guys. And a lot of what gets talked about with fintech or one of the elements of fintech
is it's the retail-facing stuff that gets talked about in the newspaper TV or whatever. And that's fair enough, and I've got nothing against those guys, and some of those services are, gee, I wish I'd thought of them.
It's a subset of fintech.
It is, and we're more fintech trading or fintech markets or something like that. So it is a very similar thing, but ours is in the professional market and a capital market, world's biggest capital market. And the changes that companies like us are bringing into capital markets have big, big effects for a long, long time, rather than the man in the street has a new app to do something that used to cost them a lot of money with an advisor.
No, indeed. And I think this is really the sort of the bleeding edge of the word fintech, which is that in nothing I've read about fintech do you get enough of a sense that if you zoom into fintech, we're talking about a bunch of actually fairly heterogeneous businesses, as we say.
Absolutely.
If you want to move some funds from sterling to euros to pay for your holiday home or something like that, that's one kind of market. Disrupting existing trading of emerging market FX is almost a completely different thing.
It is. I mean, we're niche in a niche world.
Yeah.
As it is. Very few people in the street understand how the foreign exchange market works.
And we're
in a very small subset of that particular market.
And so, again, so if I can just get my sort of highlighter out and highlight in fluorescent yellow a takeaway from here, I think one of the things that all fintechs can think about a bit more clearly is who are they disrupting? Going around meeting people and drinking coffees and trying to find all the people that need Pilates and can come on the show. 9 out of 10 people don't get to the show, and a lot of those really don't understand that. I mean, a lot of them that I've met, for example, are not trying to disrupt financial services. They're trying to disrupt software vendors into financial services. Someone will say, oh, I've got this software, I mean, I'm sure it's fantastic, and I want to sell it into a bank, and can I help them? Well, maybe. But actually, they are not disrupting financial services. No reason you have to. They're disrupting software vendors. Now, that's okay, but the most important thing is you've got to know who the competition is. Now, if you think your competition is Citigroup and HSBC, good luck to you, because it's not. Your competition is SunGuard and Murex, Lombard Risk, those kind of people.
Exactly. I mean, the area that we're focusing on is the voice broker market, right?
So are you disrupting the voice brokers, or are you their friends, or are you playing both sides of the net?
I think it's fair to say that we're not their friend.
But I thought the regulator's not their friend, because the regulator said you've got to stop talking to each other and press buttons on a computer.
Regulator isn't their friend either. but technology is not their friend, and that's the difference. So an analogy I like to use, and you and I are both old enough to know what it was like buying an airline ticket before Expedia. So you had to get on the phone, call around a bunch of brokers, shall we say, try and find out what the prices were. Often you would pay and then go maybe pick it up a couple of days later.
I used to go in Eastcheap, actually. I remember popping out of Fenchurch Street, going downstairs, around the corner, queuing up during the daytime, looking at my watch, going back, oh, sorry, I haven't got it, sir. Go back the next day, start sweating.
Exactly. And you weren't sure whether you were getting a good deal or not, but you knew that you were going next Tuesday to this particular place. Along comes Expedia.
Yeah.
Click, click, click. I can see all the bank's prices, or I can see what all of the airline's prices are. I can pick the one that suits me. I even know where I'm going to be sitting. I earn miles and all of those sorts of things. Now, that's brilliant. Everybody loves it. And that's an example of bringing an electronic solution to what was a very manual way of doing things. It also means that, the transaction cost is cheaper.
Yeah.
It typically attracts a lot more participants to that marketplace as well. It means the margin comes in a bit, for the providers, but they get a hell of a lot more business. So everybody's kind of happy with that. Regulators love that as well, because tracking an electronic market is a hell of a lot easier.
It's much more
auditable. Tracking a dark market or a market that, has voice elements to it. And so that's a big part of what we're doing. Now, this has happened all over financial markets, but there are fringes like this one where it hasn't actually made it to. Now, having done this two or three times before amongst the group that we have, you know what's going to happen. You have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen and when.
Yeah. That's an excellent point. I mean, this episode is on innovation in emerging market currency trading. And again, you're talking precisely from your experience of having innovated. One of the problems with innovation is people think they need to be incredibly innovative and come up with an idea which means you can fly to Mars with feathers. But actually, that's not really how it generally works. I mean, sometimes someone invents an electronic car or petrol car rather than an electronic pony. But the vast majority of the time, one's taking a model which has worked somewhere and applying it somewhere it hasn't been done.
Absolutely. Or putting it in bite-sized chunks that the market will accept.
Yeah.
There's
it was a different podcast, but say Bitcoin's a good example of that, right? Yeah. That is not in it being accepted, yeah. You know, in the broader professional marketplace. But there will be a service, a digital currency of some sort, that will be accepted. So if you're taking it in chunks and putting it in ways that that market sees that, okay, yes, that is a better way of doing it. I do like that innovative idea.
Yeah.
That's acceptable to me. Now, of course, we've got a big vision and the whiteboard is full and at the other end of it is a lot better, but you've got to have some steps along the way.
You need, as what's now turned into a cliche, sadly, because otherwise it's a useful word, you need to go on a journey.
Yeah, yeah.
You're here to take the customer on a journey.
Yeah,
it's just hard to say that with a straight face.
Every journey has a beginning.
Absolutely, and some of them go on forever. So moving on, you were mentioning before, John, I thought it was quite interesting, given that I've been to China a few times myself, but don't have enough time to keep my nose to what's going on with the renminbi, which I recall as fairly sort of dirty notes in my pocket. Where are we with sort of renminbis and Chinas and all these kind of things in which you guys are sort of experts?
Well, the broader story is the BRIC nations, right? So, which is where
Brazil, Russia, India, China for the non-financial services.
Correct. And South Africa, little BRICS.
BRICS.
They got added at the end there. And that's where we get our name from. All of those currencies start with the letter R.
Yes, the first time I came across you, I thought, why have they got a stupid name, RSFX? When the first thing was actually was due to my sort of lack of sufficiently smart eyesight, but it's R5FX. And then I couldn't understand why on earth you were called R5 until one day when I saw your website and it's renminbi, real, not riad.
Rand.
Rupee and?
The other one.
The other one. thanks a lot, mate. You're supposed to help me out here. Anyway, there are five R's.
And you're right. So if you look at the BRICS or the BRICS Bank, which is a new thing that, which is coming as well, three quarters of it is China, right? The emerging markets story, most of it is about China and China's effect on those other nations and the rise of those other nations from a capital market point of view, from an economic point of view, political point of view, etc. So a large amount of our focus is on RMB or renminbi because that's where a large amount of the future marketplace will be. Renminbi, like a lot of those other currencies, not all of them, is heavily restricted. That's being opened up. It's being internationalized. People's Bank of China has a very particular approach that it's using. It's very clever. It's working very, very well. They're slowly but surely internationalizing their economy. And for us, that's an extremely important thing because when that currency is fully internationalized, it will have the same effect on the foreign exchange market that euro did when the euro came along.
And that's a great soundbite and a big statement. So what do we mean by that? I'm sure you're right, but...
Well, if you parallel it perhaps with the euro and perhaps even before that, you know, coming off the gold standard and the rest of it, Bretton Woods and et cetera, the euro took several currencies and overnight turned it into one.
Mm. For better and for worse.
For better and for worse. And despite attempts to break it recently, it's held up. Now, what that meant was from a trading perspective, that was a big jump forward in electronic or technology as well, because you didn't need as many people, unfortunately.
Yeah.
The number of opportunities, the amount of hedging required was reduced.
Yeah.
The amount of capital flows, et cetera, increased quite greatly.
Yeah.
Same with China. You know, you'll see China already biggest trading partner for most countries in the world.
And it owns America anyway, in terms of the debt.
Statistics are massive. One of the best ones I ever saw was that over the last 20 millennia, China has been the world's biggest economy out of 18 of them. So
right.
For them, it's just, oh, we're just coming back to the spot
so
number
probably
one
ever
again.
Since the British made them take our opium exports. they went downhill for a couple of hundred years.
That was quite the trade and walked away with Hong Kong as a result. But the... You know, and so this has a big fundamental effect, and it will be certainly a top five very, very quickly and a top three currency internationally as well. So for us, our focus on emerging markets, Brazil, Indonesia, India, etc., but also emerging currencies, and renminbi is an emerging currency.
Ah, okay. I'd heard the phrase emerging currency before, but I never completely got my head around it, and I see what you mean, a currency that's changing.
Doesn't happen very often.
No, it doesn't happen very often, and I was actually just thinking because I'm not quite sure why, but the more time goes by, everybody else seems to get younger. I've always stayed the same age myself, and everyone's got younger, but we were talking about the financial ecosystem or the fintech ecosystem support system. I saw a bunch of mentors recently. They were 20-something. I thought, oh my God, what do these guys know? Now, I'm sure they know a lot, but you know, they'll probably know more in 30 years' time. So a lot of people listening to this may not have been around when the UK had exchange controls, as it did for most of my young life. In 1978, Margaret Thatcher removed exchange controls. Before mm-hmm. then, you couldn't just go and take as much money as you'd like and buy your euros or your Deutschmarks. So this is a progress that economies do go through. And the second point to make, and again, people in the foreign exchange markets will know this, people outside not. For people outside, they might not quite understand how you can trade in things that are restricted. Because if you can't buy and sell them, how can you buy and sell them? Well, there are these things which have been around for a while called NDFs, or they're now called ENDFs, electronic NDFs. NDF standing for non-deliverable forward. If you don't know what it is, it doesn't really matter. But basically, it's a bit like being able to we decide to bet on a horse race, but we can't actually bet on a horse race. We can still agree amongst ourselves, if this horse wins and that horse loses, I pay you £5 or vice versa. So you don't actually need to trade in the currency. You don't actually need to, it doesn't actually create volatility in that currency. It's not illegal or anything funny like that.
Not illegal at all. No, it's like a spread bet.
Spread bet, that's an even better
idea. It's like a spread bet on a currency. So like you say, there are certain countries in the world, actually quite a few of them, where they still have exchange controls. A lot of them were affected by the Asia crisis and so still have that in place. If you're an importer or an exporter, that's one thing, but they're very heavy restrictions. So if you want to take a view or hedge a big equity position or hedge a big bond position, you go to the NDF market in order to do that. So it is, by its very nature, an offshore market, an offshore currency market, which sounds a bit crazy for anybody not involved in the business, but it is like having a spread bet on, I think India is going to do well, so let me buy a bit of India for a period.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And also, just again, getting out of the financial services or getting outside the city context, we mustn't always forget that there are people doing real businesses with these countries, that they might have sterling costs, but they might have, for the sake of argument, renminbi revenues. So they've got a big risk. They want to hedge, they want to remove their risk. So it's not just a question of a bunch of guys in sort of braces who are just trying to buy and sell things just for a laugh. The genuine economic flows increasingly connecting us around globalization, and people need to manage the risk in those. So that's quite important. So coming back to the big picture, drilling up to sort of fintech as a whole, as you say, you've been involved in a variety of things over the past, which one could, if one was a consultant, rebrand one's entire CV as having done sort of nothing but fintech from the age of about sort of 16 years old, no doubt. You've seen it before it kind of existed in the way that we think of fintech now. I mean, where do you think it's going in the next few years? Get the crystal ball out.
Ooh, okay. Big question.
And I'm recording all of this, and I'll come back in 5 years' time. And
big question, yes. I think there's a number of things that are going on. I think fintech is just an easy term to use for something that's always been there. And it sounds like a very much like a VC term of like, okay, this is a sector that, you know, that we're
media
that
tech
that we're going to invest in.
30% of the portfolio in fintech.
Exactly. And what that means is it makes it sexy, right? Yeah. So everybody starts using that term.
Oh, do you mean we're cool then?
We are very cool.
I mean, you're
cool.
Quite cool. I'm not so sure about myself, but anyway.
We're awesomely cool. And the, you know, so you've got
it's
that.
It's a good job there isn't video on this.
That's next. You've got that element to it. So London, quite rightly so, is promoting itself quite heavily as being the home of fintech, and why shouldn't it be? Which I'm a big fan of and a big supporter of, because it makes the lives of people trying to build fintech companies a lot easier when they have support both from government, from funders, from customers, from the media. It makes that whole journey a hell of a lot easier to do, and I think that's a brilliant thing. The Chancellor has announced a bunch of support for fintech, and I think a lot of that will filter through. And as is all to build an ecosystem here in the UK, in the same way that you've got in California for technology companies in general. They have something similar in Sweden and in Israel. You know, they've got this nice little sort of ecosystem that goes around. No reason why that shouldn't happen here in London. And the gate is opened on that. You do start to see people sort of pouring into this now, which is a good thing. You've got all of that put into the boiling, you know, sort of
melting pot.
And I think that's a very, very good thing. There will certainly be some companies that will do very, very well out of that. There'll be a bunch that doesn't really work out at all. That's fairly standard. I do think you'll see a lot of that 19-year-old, graduate wanting to go and work in fintech. Now, rather than
in the 1980s, it was merchant banks. Everybody wanted to work in a merchant bank, and it was very cool and very reputable.
It was. It was the place to be. Yeah. And dot-coms were the place to be in 95, 96.
It's a good counter indicator. Whatever new graduates want to pile into, you should be selling. So hopefully, they don't want to all pile into fintech yet, because otherwise, it'd be time to be getting out.
Coming back to Eddie's comment of it's, you know, we're on year two of a 10-year cycle, I think he's dead right. And I think, you know, we're here in Canary Wharf here at the moment. a number of the large players down here, or even the medium-sized players, in 5-10 years from now will be the startups of today. And you don't have to have it grow out of a big firm anymore. Literally, a couple of guys in an office somewhere can pull it off and do it themselves.
I think that's a very good note to end on, that we've not just gone through this quantitative change, i.e. it's 10 times cheaper to set up a fintech than 10 years ago. There's also a qualitative change in that these days you can kind of take on the banks or kind of take on the software vendors, whereas 10 years ago it would have been much tougher to do so.
Absolutely.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you very much for that, John, and I wish you all your success in disrupting the market and taking the whole project forward. Thanks for that.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts of new episodes. Live long and prosper.
Could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.